The start of Paul Manafort's trial, also a topic for us tomorrow on River to River Politics Day. We'll also talk about what I'm seeing is a tweet from the president, collusion is not a crime. We'll explore that tomorrow on the program, updates on the Russia probe. Well, let's continue on with politics in this second half hour of River to River. Kelly Winfrey is with us of Iowa State University. We want to talk about gender balance, also the impact of gender in a bigger picture on the 2018 midterms. Of course, we've been hearing how big a year after our primaries, a big year for women candidates, 2018. Kelly is assistant professor in the Greenlee School of Journalism and Communication at ISU, also on the faculty of the Leadership Studies Program for the Carrie Chapman Katz Center for Women in Politics. Kelly, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me, Ben.
Let's start with a new study that looks at Iowa's counties and their gender balance. I understand they're having some trouble achieving gender balance on boards, commissions as required by state law. Tell us, what did this study look at and why?
So what we were looking at was the makeup of seven boards or commissions that are pretty common across Iowa counties. And we were looking to see what the gender composition was. In 2009, the legislature passed a gender balance requirement for all county and municipal boards and commissions. So these are appointed positions, usually in the case of counties, appointed by the Board of Supervisors. And that law required that gender balance be a priority. And so since that law went into effect January 1st of 2012, we've been looking at this gender composition on county boards and commissions every couple of years. And what we found, in the first couple studies we did, we saw a big improvement in some areas. So from our study that we did in 2014 to 2016, there was a 9% improvement in the number of boards that were gender balanced. Mm-hmm. But from 2016 to 2018, it's 0.28% change.
Oh.
So okay. We had some big gains.
Pretty much flat.
Yeah. Yeah. And in some cases on certain boards, we actually saw some gains go away or decrease from the previous study that we did.
Mm-hmm. So how do you account for the jump, the increase, the improvement towards equity, the balance in gender, and then this leveling off? Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think two big things are, whenever the law was first passed, there was a lot of attention both by the people that were doing the appointing, as well as people that might be interested in serving on those boards and commissions. So maybe more women were applying and counties were doing more to recruit diverse candidate pools to achieve gender balance. And as time passed, it's possible that either those recruitment efforts plateaued or weren't as strong as they were, or they kind of just reached a point where they got a lot of people that were interested and they weren't finding new ways to get new candidates in there.
Mm-hmm. So by the way you stated it, this is an aspiration that the state lawmakers made. It's not something where, if we don't meet this, then something happens. There's no punishment here, right?
Yeah, that's correct. So we also have a gender balance requirement for the state boards and commissions, mm-hmm. and they do a very good job at the state level of making sure that they're balanced not only by gender, but also by political party. The law that applies to counties and municipalities requires a good faith effort be made to balance boards and commissions. But if, and that's not clearly defined. And the code also gives a 3-month grace period to fill a vacant position. And if you can't find a candidate that would make it gender balanced after 3 months, you can just fill it with whoever is qualified for that position. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of kind of flexibility in how the law is implemented. And like you mentioned, there's no real enforcement to it. So mm-hmm. there's no punishment to counties that don't achieve gender balance. When the bill was being discussed, there was an amendment that was proposed that would have required reports be made to the Iowa Commission on Status of Women. That amendment was withdrawn because legislators that were pushing the bill felt that that was going to prevent it from passing. So that's what we try to do at the Katz Center, is try to hold those counties accountable and kind of see what progress is being made.
When you look in broad brushstroke terms here, how does Iowa compare when it comes to gender balance at this level, or even the state, county, or state level with other states?
You know, there's not a whole lot of studies out there on the actual numbers, especially at local levels. Iowa is actually the only state in the country that has a state law requiring gender balance at county and municipal boards and commissions. So in terms of having legislation on the books that at least aspires towards gender balance, Iowa is ahead of a lot of states. There are seven other states that have that requirement for their state boards and commissions. So there's Iowa's not doing bad in terms of legislating, but in terms of actually achieving it, we're not quite reaching the goals that we set.
Mm-hmm. Any other things that jumped out at you in this new study before we move on?
Well, I think what's interesting is when we look at the different types of boards and commissions, we see some more glaring differences. And this has been the case in previous years. Some boards have more authority or are better pipelines for people that might be interested in running for elective office, things like planning and development boards, for example. And those are boards that are struggling with gender balance. But we see more gender balance on places like boards of health. So it's not just as a whole, but looking at those specific boards and making sure that they that women are represented in all of those different areas.
Mm-hmm. Does this study look at any of the reasons why women choose to fill these positions or not fill these positions?
No, we strictly looked at numbers. And, you know, I'll say from our experience with our campaign training program, our Ready to Run Iowa program, one of the things we do is encourage women to serve on these boards and commissions because it is a good opportunity to start getting involved in government. You know, a lot of times women aren't even aware that there is a gender balance law or aren't clear on how to go about applying for those boards and commissions. So that can be a hang up that prevents people from applying. Sometimes the way people get appointed is they know someone who says, hey, there's an opening on this board.
Mm-hmm.
You should be on it. And so sometimes women aren't in those networks that kind of fast track them into those positions.
Mm-hmm. I think you're hinting at it here, but elaborate on why gender balance at the county and local levels is important.
Yeah, I mean, the big thing is that it serves as a pipeline for women in politics. A lot of our state legislators at some point served on local county or state boards and commissions. It's a way to also not just get political experience, but build your political network, build your political expertise. So it's important for getting more women in politics at higher levels as well. And I'll say the other thing that I think is worth noting is that there's a lot of research both on policymaking and group decision making that shows that when you have diverse groups, so that includes gender diversity as well as racial diversity, age diversity, income diversity, you get better decision making and better policy making.
Kelly Winfrey is with us this second half hour of River to River, assistant professor in the Greenlee School of Journalism and Communication at ISU. She's also with the Carrie Chapman Katz Center for Women in Politics, also at ISU. Well, let's sort of broaden our scope a little bit and talk about women running for office countrywide in this midterm. We're pretty much through. Not sure if we're completely through the primary season. A big year in any case for women candidates. Remind us how big a year. This is a record year for women running for office.
Yes. You know, I'd still like to see more women running, but it is a record-breaking year in terms of the number of women that are running. We have, in all levels of office, seen record numbers. You know, here in Iowa, we have 84 women that won their primary races, which broke the previous record of 65 women in our general election for the state legislature or statewide offices. And nationally, we're seeing very similar things. We have, it's pretty remarkable. We have, let me see, I had my numbers here. About 24% of all candidates for the U.S. House are women. But that's up from 2016, which was 18% of all mm-hmm. candidates were women. And we have an all-time high of 468 women running for the U.S. House and 51 for the U.S. Senate. And those are women that were competing in primaries. And then, you know, some of those are have already won their primary. We do still have a few primary elections in some interesting states in August, throughout August, and some even in early September.
What's driving women into seek political office, as far as you can tell?
Well, the driving force behind this increase is really the number of Democratic women. The Center for American Women in Politics had some numbers on this and found that 33% of all Democratic candidates were women, compared to only 14% of all Republican candidates. So women on the left have been particularly mobilized. I think the 2016 election, we saw the result of that, the Hillary Clinton's loss, gender issues that still surround Donald Trump, really mobilizing women to be more politically active. And then kind of going along with that was the Me Too movement and discussions about sexual harassment and sexual assault that really brought some issues to the spotlight that are of particular interest to women. And I think it kind of mirrors what happened in 1992 as a response to the Anita Hill hearings, where sexual harassment became a national conversation, and the lack of women as senators was highlighted during those Anita Hill hearings.
Mm-hmm. Kelly, we're rapidly running out of time. I wanted to get to some audio here because I wanted to sort of focus on the shift you may see in the way women are expressing themselves as candidates. But as a preface to that, let's listen to an expression of one candidate, one woman who won a primary in Iowa's 1st District for Congress, Abby Finkenauer, 29 years old, running against the incumbent, a second-term incumbent, Rod Blum. If she wins, she may be the youngest woman in Congress. That is unless Ocasio-Cortez wins. I believe Ocasio-Cortez is even younger. I think she's 28.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Well, it's her relative youth as a headline that has drawn both support and criticism from voters and interested parties. This is what Abby Finkenauer has to say about those who think her age or inexperience may make her unfit for Congress from one of her ads.
They said the state house would be too tough for a young lady. Then they said that a girl still paying off her student loans wasn't tough enough to beat a millionaire for Congress. Well, I say, watch me. Because I'm from Eastern Iowa. We take care of business, and we take care of each other. And we invented tough.
Okay, I think that ad is called Tough.
Yeah.
Your reaction. What did you hear there about the way Abby Finkenauer is portraying herself?
I think the big thing is she's highlighting her toughness, right? A stereotypical masculine trait. So sometimes women are seen as not being as tough as men, so maybe not being as good of leaders. And she really emphasizes that she's tough and that where she's from respects that sort of hard work. And really kind of adapts to those expectations that are sometimes gendered for leadership.
Right. And she does girls with her voice,
yes.
Girl in quotes, right?
Yeah.
And it's interesting. She goes right for declares one of her own, you could see it as a perceived weakness, right?
Mm-hmm.
Girl who is still paying for student debts, right? You put that in your campaign ad.
Yeah. Well, and I think, you know, it's part of what she does a great job of in that ad is being relatable. As we look at millennials and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez falls into the same category of young women who are talking about kind of a more income-based or democratic socialist-based position. Not that Abby Finkenauer identifies as a democratic socialist, but that she's talking about these issues that particularly relate to young people. And, I mean, I can attest, you know, young people have a lot of student loan debt, and that's something that's an issue. So even just mentioning that that's part of her being probably relates to some voters.
Right. It gets her out of being accused of in any way being elite, right, if
yes.
you have student debt.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Let's listen to a part of an ad from another woman, this one running to unseat the U.S. Congressman John Carter in Texas's 31st District, M.J. Hagar. She's an Air Force combat veteran, served three tours in Afghanistan, a mother, an author, a teacher. In her viral campaign ad, Hagar describes the crash that closed the door on her military pilot career and placed her on a path toward politics.
That got me a Purple Heart, and I became the second woman ever awarded the Distinguished Flying Cross with Valor. But after that, the door closed. Injured and unable to fly, I was barred from my next career choice because I was a woman.
Hi.
So I came home. I worked in healthcare and business. I got married and started my family.
Wait, barred because I was a woman? That's ridiculous.
So I sued the Pentagon, but not just about that job, about the ban on women serving in all ground combat jobs. And I went to DC to lobby Congress, but door after door was slammed in my face. I heard things like, my boss agrees with you, but you aren't in a position to do anything for him. You're not one of our donors. Well, eventually,
we are eliminating the direct ground combat exclusion rule for women.
We won. And that opened the door for hundreds of thousands of women to compete for elite ground combat jobs. A major victory for our military.
Hold on, back up a minute. Not one of his donors? That's not how this is supposed to work.
One of those closed doors was my congressman, Tea Party Republican John Carter. Apparently, being his constituent and a veteran wasn't enough to get a meeting. I guess I also needed to be a donor. So now I'm running against him, taking on a system that cares more about campaign donors and political parties than protecting our country. Congressman Carter hasn't had a tough race his entire career. So
we'll show him tough. Then we'll show him the door.
Okay, there's that word tough again, Kelly.
Yeah.
What did you hear there about the way MJ Hager of Texas is portraying herself as a candidate?
Again, a tough woman and fighting for gender equality. She doesn't hide from the fact that she's a woman and that she's a mom, but she also emphasizes her toughness. Earlier, and that's like a 3-minute web video, so I encourage everyone to go watch it online. Like you said, it went viral. It is a great ad. And earlier in the ad, she talks also about her experience with her mom experiencing domestic violence. And so all these gender-related issues and this clear kind of tough persona of a combat veteran who was willing to fight really makes her stand out from a lot of candidates. And the ad itself is so well-written and produced that it does a great job, I think, of persuading women voters and men voters as well, that MJ is somebody that could get the job done and that might better represent her constituents.
Mm-hmm. A recipe that has worked here in Iowa when we think of the successful candidacy of Joni Ernst. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to think of is it 3 or 4 words that she described herself with during her campaign, soldier, mother, conservative?
Yeah. Yeah.
Did I get those 3 right?
Yeah.
Their tough was part of her campaign as well. We remember one of the ads getting on some kind of big motorcycle, driving to a shooting range, right?
Yeah.
And she's a combat veteran. She's been abroad.
Yeah. She's another great example of really balancing gender stereotypes or adapting to gender expectations of saying, yeah, I'm a mom, but I'm also tough. I've been in the military. Amy McGrath in Kentucky is another candidate that has used a similar style. She's also a combat pilot and is challenging, a 20-year incumbent. So another really, because now we've had more women that have been in these military roles, they can now run on that sort of record that used to be exclusive for male candidates.
Mm-hmm. And so we're past the era, would you say, completely where women candidates were encouraged to put on a pantsuit, recite the resume, downplay the family, kids, downplay their gender?
No.
Okay.
I think we've certainly made progress, but I think all these ads that we've looked at have really showed how women have to balance. You know, they can talk about being a woman or a mom, but they also have to show that they're tough. It's still harder for female candidates. They still get more questions about things like childcare when they're in office, you know, who's going to take care of your kids, than male candidates get. They still get criticized more for the way they look than male candidates do. So there's still a double bind that women face, but I do think that it's getting better, and women candidates are getting are finding new ways to negotiate that terrain.
Mm-hmm. We have about a minute left, and I know you have a book, I think, coming out in the fall on female voters.
Yes.
In the minute remaining, what can you tell us about women voters? We are within 100 days, less than 100 days of the midterms.
Well, I think the big thing is that there are important differences between how men and women vote and view political issues. And one thing that I do in the book is look at those gender differences, but I also look at differences between women and how being a woman influences their position on issues and the candidates that they support. So really, I'm kind of looking at how women view their role in society and how that influences their vote choice. And in some cases, it means that women prefer women candidates because they think that they can better represent represent their interests.
Mm-hmm. Are you saying some women will vote for a female candidate simply because of her gender?
Usually it's within party. So you see it more often in primary races where the policy differences are not as big. So, you know, if it's of the same party, then there are certainly women that will prefer a female candidate because they see that she has more similar experiences to them.
Kelly Winfrey, we'll look for a longer discussion, more in-depth discussion about your book when it comes out this fall. But thank you very much for this conversation.
Thanks, Ben.
Kelly Winfrey, assistant professor at the Greenlee School of Journalism and Communication, also with the Carrie Chapman Katz Center for Women in Politics at Iowa State University. River to River is produced by Caitlin Harrop, Emily Woodbury, and Lindsay Moon. Help today also from Shirley Wong. Catherine Perkins is our executive producer. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. Tomorrow, of course, Politics Day. Collusion is not a crime. That's a tweet from our president within the last few hours. Also, the start of the Paul Manafort trial, the trial of Donald Trump's former campaign manager. We'll talk about that. Plenty more. Politics Day tomorrow. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.